They were rookie mistakes from rookie hands dealing with complex experimental procedures. I'm better than that, he thought. He was an experienced scientist now, an expert in his field, one of the best. So what if this time the organism he was operating on was a bit larger than what he was used to? He could do this. Sonia, call up the procedure for an emergency cerebrospinal ventral drain implantation from your medical database, Emmanuel said. The displays around the rear of the Rhino switched on. They showed, step by step, what Emmanuel had to do. He laid Sophie as gently as he could on the Rhino's floor. This was no operating table, and there were no surgical lamps hanging overhead, but it would have to do. The Rhino jostled again as the damaged suspension system fought against the raging winds and the unpredictable terrain. Hold Sophie steady, Emmanuel said to Holly. Balma, Ort, a little help over here. The two soldiers knelt around Sophie. Emmanuel did the best he could to ignore the jostling of the vehicle and Diego's erratic driving as the soldier attempted to evade the organics. His mind switched to surgical mode. He had not forgotten the feeling of clinical precision and focus, as he'd feared. Every movement came out of his fingers like computer output from commands he'd entered into a terminal. His eyes left his focus on Sophie's skull only to gauge his progress in relation to the steps displayed by Sonia. His fingers worked deftly to create an insertion point. He was almost done. Finally, he inserted a small shunt into the back of Sophie's skull. Clear, viscous fluid flowed from the shunt, spilling into the mess of cryostat fluid already coating the floor of the Rhino. Got it, Emmanuel said. He stared at the biomonitor. The warning still flashed, reporting the intracranial pressure was too high. He didn't take his eyes off the screen, daring it to defy his efforts. This will work. This will... The warning disappeared. The EKG beeped with the report of a normal cardiac rhythm. He carefully placed Sophie on her back and cradled her head, brushing back the hair from her face. It had been months since they'd been this close, and his heart overflowed with emotions as he studied her near-translucent skin. Vaguely, he sensed the others surrounding them, but they were nothing more than shadows in the night to him. Sophie was still alive, still fighting. As long as you keep fighting, Emmanuel thought. I will, too. When she'd gone into the cryo chamber, she'd been unconscious. Even with his intervention, there was no indication that Emmanuel's work would do anything to change that. So, when Sophie's eyes fluttered open, he reared back with shock and surprise.
Chapter 9
A grating wind cut across the mangled body of the chitinous alien. Spidery legs twitched, and blue blood pulsed out of its cracked flesh. The creature had been thrown into its current position at the tunnel's entrance by the intense blast that had swallowed the landscape only moments ago. "You okay?" Jeff asked. He kept one eye on the spider as he bent low near his brother. David managed a nod. The dust and rocks blasted past just outside the narrow tunnel they were sheltered in. Winds roared against the rock with a monstrous force that frightened Jeff even more than the organics did. I think so, David said. He sat against the wall of the tunnel, staring at the broken spider. Is it dead? The wind tugged at the spider's fragile flesh, whipping at the skull. Jeff guessed it was being held in place by its claws alone, which were embedded in the rock. That same strength must have been what let the organics use the dust storm for cover where normal humans would be simply blown away. And to shreds. Looks like it, Jeff said, eyeing the spider's mandibles. The alien had chased them from their original hiding spot, overlooking the route from the dawn to the sunspot, before they had killed it. As they were running, desperate to put some distance between themselves and it, Jeff had seen the plasma start to vent from the sunspot. It had risen into the sky like the finger of some great giant reaching for the heavens. He knew something had gone wrong, and had debated taking David back to the sunspot to find out what it was. Thankfully, all his instincts had told him to stay away. Maybe it was luck they'd slid into this tunnel to escape the spider. A blinding flash had swallowed them as they dove inside. His vision had gone completely white for several seconds, and at first he had thought he'd gone blind. But it was back now. David was still alive, and so was he. That left him with one question he was afraid to ask aloud. David wasn't. "Do you think everyone else is dead?" Jeff could see his brother wanted reassurance that Holly, Balma, and the others had survived, but Jeff couldn't lie.
"I don't know,"
he finally said. He slumped down next to David and put an arm around his shoulder. He tried pressing a button on his suit to call the ship. "Emmanuel? Sonya? Anyone? Do you read?" There was nothing but static. Again he tried. "Holly, are you there?" But no matter what he tried, there was no response. His stomach sank. Maybe in his attempt to alter the suits for him and David, he'd ripped off the comm units that connected them with the ship. Sonya might not even know they were missing.
"Oh, no,"
he muttered.
"I screwed up."
David tried to comfort him, but Jeff shrugged him off. He'd set out to prove he and David could help the others, that they were just as good as the adults. Now they were stuck out here, alone, with a dead spider. The winds continued to roar outside. Piles of broken rock and dirt started to build up at the tunnel's entrance. If this storm continued for too long, Jeff and his brother would be buried alive. A gauge on his suit's HUD showed that his oxygen levels were running low. He wouldn't be able to survive more than a couple hours longer out here if he didn't get the suit recharged. He wanted to look brave, but tears threatened to pour down his face. He wanted to curl into a ball and go to sleep, to wake up and find this was all a dream. Maybe he'd wake up on the sunspot in the safety of the others. Then he remembered something his dad had liked to tell him and David. "Bravery doesn't mean you aren't afraid. It means that you do something even when you are afraid." Jeff needed to be brave now.
"Stay here, okay?"
"What are you going to do?"
David asked, worry tinging his voice.
"I gotta make sure that we keep the entrance to the tunnel open," Jeff said.
"I'll help."
Images of David being swept away in the intense winds flashed through Jeff's mind.
"No, you stay back here. Warn me if you see any organic activity. Plus, you can stay safe and help me if I need it."
David nodded meekly. Jeff climbed toward the entrance of the tunnel. Pebbles carried by the wind bounced against his suit the closer he got. He shoveled away the piles of dust and rocks with his hands, scooping them up and spreading them along the floor of the tunnel toward where David sat. The pull of the wind tugged at his suit, threatening to drag him outside so he maintained a safe distance from the entrance of the tunnel. The body of the spider slapped against the ground, its lifeless, arachnid-like eyes staring at Jeff while he worked to keep the tunnel clear. Each second that passed seemed like he was losing the battle. Every handful of dirt and rock he moved from the entrance was replaced by two more. Sweat trickled over his face and stung his eyes. Only a pinprick of space existed between the growing pile of debris and the roof of the tunnel. His muscles burned, but he went into overdrive. If he failed, David would be buried too. They'd die in here, choking on their own breath. Scoop by scoop, he tore at the pile of rock and dirt. The wind ate away at the other side of the pile, even as it added to it, sounding through his suit like a growling monster. First, the aliens had tried to kill them, and now Mars was having a go. Fear threatened to take hold of Jeff again, urging his muscles to lock and freeze, but he wouldn't let it win. His dad's words kept repeating in his head, and he dug and dug and dug. A new clunking sound replaced the din of the howling storm. The entire face of the scree suddenly slipped into the tunnel and onto him, the dirt settling against his chest and limbs, pinning him to the ground. He tried desperately to breathe, but an immense pressure pushed down on his chest. A wet sheen formed over his eyes, and his vision blurred. Panic took hold, telling him to thrash and flail to fight for his life, but he couldn't so much as twitch his fingers. He was completely stuck. The clatter of rock against rock came again, and Jeff waited for the added weight to crush him. Here he would stay, left to lie for eternity while his brother suffered because he'd failed. But instead of feeling the press of more rocks, the weight on his chest lessened. A flood of white light washed over his body. David looked down at him, his helmet-mounted light illuminating his small hands as he shoveled Jeff free.
"I got you, bro,"
David said. Soon Jeff's hands were free, and he was able to help David uncover the rest of his body. Finally out, he sat and gasped for breath.
"You okay?"
David asked.
"I think so."
Jeff marveled at how quickly things had changed. He'd been asking David the same question before, then telling his little brother to stay out of harm's way in an attempt to protect him. Fate had other surprises in store, and in the end, it was David who had saved him. Jeff figured it was more proof that they were an inseparable team. He brushed the front of his suit off. A red warning flashed at the corner of his HUD. Oxygen levels were at only 10%.
"Did it stop?"
David asked him.
"What?" "The storm."
Jeff looked at the entrance, at the hole the slip had cleared. The wind still carried swirls of brown and red, but he no longer felt the intense pull of the storm trying to drag him from the tunnel.
"Looks like it's settled,"
he said.
"How's your oxygen?"
"It says 15%.
Better than his, but David wouldn't make it alone if Jeff's ran out. From what Jeff knew about their suits, there were a couple of options to replenish their oxygen stores. The first was directly depositing some tank-like canisters into the suit. The other option was to find an environment with adequate oxygen levels to peel them off and let them harvest air from the atmosphere. He'd seen Bauma do this a couple of times when he was testing the suits, but besides the sunspot, he wasn't sure there was anywhere he could find an oxygen-rich environment to recharge their oxygen systems.
"We need to recharge our air supplies,"
Jeff said.
"I know there were extra canisters aboard the sunspot, assuming it's still there."
"Maybe we will find the others,"
David said. The two brothers climbed out of their shelter to be greeted by the sight of the spider carcass. A few of its legs had been shorn off by the shrapnel of the dust storm, but it still clung stubbornly to the rock face. Farther out, the bodies of the spiders they'd ambushed littered the ravine, their limbs protruding out of the dirt the storm had deposited over them. Jeff climbed to the top of the precipice. Wind whispered over his suit, and he helped David up beside him. Below lay a plateau that had been blasted almost smooth as marble. This was where the sunspot had crash-landed. All the little craters and rocky columns were gone, and the sunspot was nothing more than a husk of blackened metal. It looked like when their dad had left a fish too long on the grill. There was no doubt now. The flash of light had been the sunspot exploding. Jeff doubted there would be any intact oxygen canisters in the wreckage.
But they had to look.
"We're going to go down there?"
David asked nervously. It wasn't just the prospect of a futile search that worried David. And Jeff. Rather, the broken sunspot wasn't alone. Nearly a dozen spiders were scurrying over the landscape around it, and some scorpion-like monstrosities paced the perimeter of the plateau. Beyond them lay a few organic fighters, similar to the winged ones with the dorsal fins they'd seen in space. Between those fighters were much larger ships, Jeff judged to be some kind of transport craft. Jeff and David got down on their bellies to watch.
"What's that?"
David asked, pointing toward the horizon beyond the sunspot. Jeff used his hand to shield his eyes under his visor. A small dust cloud billowed from a speck in the distance. It seemed to be moving. There was no blue glint like it was an organic alien.
Maybe. Just maybe. It was a human vehicle.
But it was racing away.
"Is that a rhino?"
David asked.
"I don't know."
If it was, there was no way they could catch up to it on foot. Jeff surveyed the landscape, crawling with organics and all the debris around the broken sunspot. The aliens seemed to be searching for something, and he had a feeling it was their missing friends. Jeff eyed the alien ships again, an idea forming in his mind.
"If we can get on board one of those,"
he pointed to an alien ship,
"maybe we can find Bauma and the others. The aliens are looking for them."
David looked over.
"Are you crazy, bro?"
Jeff shrugged.
Maybe a little.
Sophie floated above the Martian surface, a complex and hostile landscape of ravines and mountains carved by ancient tectonic activity and rivers that had long since disappeared. A flash in the distance blinded her momentarily. When her vision cleared, she once again focused on the alien landscape, suddenly overwhelmed by a strange sensation that this was her home. But Mars never was my home, she thought. So why do I feel so nostalgic? A vague memory floated back to her in that ethereal moment. At once she saw all that had transpired since the organics invaded Earth and upended her life and the lives of billions of others. She felt the pain and anguish of knowing the rest of her family was gone forever. She was among a handful of humans left to linger until the planet breathed its last breath and the organics had taken all they had come for. But all of that seemed so distant now as she floated above Mars. Another flash of light tore through the sky like a meteor coming into the thin Mars atmosphere. But this was not a meteor. The ship streaking through the sky was the sunspot, and she knew she was glimpsing not the present, but rather an event that had occurred not so long ago. She had been on that ship, and was watching herself crash to Mars. A plume of dust rose above the crash site, and a voice boomed within her skull, a voice she hadn't heard in a long time, but one she knew exceedingly well. "Welcome home, Sophie."
Dr. Eric Hoffman. And intense pain overwhelmed her. All that she saw turned a brilliant red. 1,000 tiny needles pierced every bone in her body.
The Mars surface blurred, to be replaced by what looked like metal walls. Distant voices called out in a muddled jumble of sound, but none of them belonged to Hoffman.
"Sophie," one of them said. The tone was soft, kind, reassuring. It pulled at her from a distance, tugging her back to reality. She blinked. Hovering over her were the familiar eyes of the man she had grown to appreciate as much more than just a colleague, the man who had brought her out of whatever cocoon the nanobots had hidden her away in.
"Emmanuel,"
she choked. Pain lanced her throat, and she tasted something metallic. He pulled her in close to his chest until she could feel his heartbeat against the side of her head. A dull pain throbbed at the back of her skull, but it no longer seemed to matter.
"You have no idea how glad I am to hear your voice," he said. "I never thought I'd see you conscious again."
Sophie sensed the presence of others nearby. They lurked on the periphery, like kind spirits edging into existence but not wanting to interrupt. For that she was thankful. All manner of emotions crashed through her, and she couldn't take the demands of anyone else asking how she was or finding out someone was missing or hurt. Seeing and being with Emmanuel helped her to heal something that had broken in her mind. After a few moments of shared silence with him, the rest of the world came into focus. She felt the tremble of a vehicle underneath her and heard the whine of electric motors. Her skin felt cool, and the thin suit she wore was soaked in some kind of liquid. The air smelled of body odor, sweat, and the sweet scent of cryostat fluid. Holly and Balma were there too, and so were Owen and Jamie. Diego and another big man she didn't recognize sat at the controls of the vehicle. She craned her neck to see who else had survived, but the rest of the seats were empty. Was this all that remained of her team? And humanity? Where were Jeff and David? Chapter 10. The jolt of the ship coming to a stop knocked Captain Noble to the floor of his orb, but he quickly pushed himself back up. Pulling on the coiled feeding cord attached to his stomach, he stood and made his way back to the wall of his prison. A massive recessed light in the overhead of the chamber flipped on, spreading brilliant white illumination throughout the entire space. Noble's eyes adjusted to the sight of hundreds and hundreds of alien prisoners in orbs. He could see all the way across the chamber, and while the aliens imprisoned there were just dots, he could make out some of their myriad colors. Some appeared as cool teals, like the Caribbean Ocean, while others were orange, like flames. He slowly took in the view. Three orbs above and to the right was some sort of gas entity. At first he thought it was one of the multidimensional entities, but it was definitely different, a nebulous cloud slowly circulating inside the orb. A few orbs to the right, an alien with two necks and eyeless red glowing bulbs attached to each swayed from a base that looked like a flower pot sculpted of bone. In another orb below, Noble saw a puddle of gray liquid that transformed into the figures of other aliens, mimicking the shapes of those around it. Noble's eyes widened when the liquid formed the shape of a human. These creatures were beyond remarkable. There was something awe-inspiring about seeing such a diversity of creatures. In a way, he felt lucky to experience what he was witnessing. Life forms from all across the solar system, the galaxy, and perhaps even beyond. The opening of the ship's belly far below squashed any feeling of good fortune he had attained. The screech of metal sounded as the doors began to part, revealing a lumpy, gray surface below. Noble stepped close enough to the wall of his orb that his hair should have prickled, but his beard remained matted to his chin. Cautiously, he poked the gooey skin wall. His finger pushed into the oozing substance. He pulled it back, and a string of jelly came away with his finger. The force field was down. A sudden sharp pain ripped through his gut. He yelled in agony. The cord retracted from his stomach, accompanied by a loud hiss. It whipped to the floor, where it vanished into a slot that resealed. Noble reached down to grab at the bleeding wound in his abdomen. A small red hole not much bigger than a pea flashed with pain. He pressed his palm over the swollen flesh and staggered a few feet to the other side of his prison for a better look below. The hangar doors continued opening in a screech that drowned out the grunting, croaking, panting, and other noises of the riled-up aliens. The liquid entity had taken on the shape of a human again and was screaming. Noble swallowed hard when he realized it was the same voice he had heard earlier. The festering hope of finding another person on the organic ship drained out of him like the liquid from an orb. He forced himself to look back down at the ground, which was rising to meet the ship. Mounds shaped like anthills dotted the terrain that stretched under the open doors, and miniature creatures moved in lines out of the holes, like insects. An alien spacecraft shot by below the ship, the raucous sound of its engines vibrating throughout the chamber. Roots waved its spindly arms back and forth and dropped from the top of its orb to the floor. Several alien noises rang out. Ribbit stood on both its chicken legs and looked down. The creature croaked and groaned. Still sick, Noble judged by the crusty goo covering its cracked hide.
You have arrived.
The voice in Noble's head came at the same time the other alien prisoners all started to move and make noises. Ribbit, who tilted his oval head, appeared perplexed. Even Roots seemed distracted, its arms waving back and forth like it was trying to communicate. The liquid alien had reformed into a puddle on the ground, and ripples undulated over it.
You have arrived,
repeated the voice in his mind. He wasn't imagining it. This was the same multidimensional entity that had communicated with him before.
The four shimmering figures had returned in the center of the chamber.
All at once, they fanned out to check on their specimens. Normally, the other aliens were quiet at the sight of the overlords, but not this time.
Did they know something he didn't? Stay calm.
This time Noble wasn't sure if the words came from the aliens or if he was saying it in his own mind. He wasn't sure what to believe or think right now. What he did know was the dead gray surface they were headed toward wasn't Earth. The gray surface reminded him of dead skin. As the ship descended farther, the aliens on the surface skittered away. Now Noble saw them clearly. They were spiders. Thousands of them. Dust swirled beneath the ship, blocking his view of the pockmarked surface of this alien planet and the creatures that lived here. His gaze flitted to the apparition floating toward his orb.
"Where are we?" Noble asked.
The reply came in his mind.
"Your destination."
"And where is that?"
he asked.
"Your species called this place the moon."
Noble blinked, trying to process the information.
"Our moon? Like the moon that orbits Earth?"
"It is the same."
The dust settled below as the ship landed with a jolt that rocked the bulkheads. The vibration knocked Noble to the floor. He pushed himself back up as the creature flickered away, leaving him standing at the edge of the orb.
"Prepare yourself, Captain Rick Noble."
The voice echoed in his mind, and he slowly peered out of the orb. Below, a small, cigar-shaped alien ship flew under the open doors and glided into the center of the chamber. Orbs on the bottom level shot away from the bulkheads and attached to the side of the ship like metal flakes to a magnet. Roots looked up at Noble, just as its orb ripped away from the wall and slammed into the ship. As the ship made its way up toward his level, Noble shivered and moved away from the bulkhead. He was next. The hum of the Rhino's motors was their constant companion as they shot over the Martian surface. They were still headed in the general direction of where the NTC colony was supposed to be. Like a car driving in the night with no headlights, in hopes of running into a city hidden in the sand, Bauma thought. They were relying on hope and a bit of luck. After all, stranger things had happened. He was seated in the rear of the Rhino, next to Sophie and Emmanuel. Diego and Ort manned the cockpit, and Holly was still making sure the kids were faring the best they could through their trauma. Right now she was getting them to settle into naps. Bauma still couldn't believe Sophie had been resurrected from her slumbers and was, against all odds, lucid. Then again, maybe it wasn't good fortune that she'd been able to wake up like that. It probably had something to do with the nanobots. He studied Sophie for a moment when she closed her eyes. Even though she claimed not to be in pain any longer, her skin still looked taut and pale. Her lips seemed locked in a permanent grimace when she wasn't talking. "Damn, but it's good to see you awake, Sophie," Bauma said. She massaged her temples, and when she spoke, her words came out groggily.
"I'm glad to see we're in one piece."
A look of worry crossed her face.
"We still haven't heard anything from Jeff and David?"
Bauma shook his head. "Sonya's been looking for any signals that might be coming from an EVA suit, but we haven't gotten any hits yet."
"Those two boys are tough,"
Sophie said.
"We'll find them."
Bauma caught Holly's eyes. He knew her well enough to sense what was going on in her mind. Even if Jeff and David had somehow survived the reactor failure of the sunspot, they wouldn't survive out there for long. They were tough, there was no doubt about that. Bauma knew it well enough from training them back in Cheyenne Mountain, but no matter how good shots they were, they couldn't survive out there without food, water, or oxygen.
"I shouldn't be alive,"
Sophie said, coming back to her senses. She looked at Emmanuel.
"This must have something to do with the nanobots."
So Bauma wasn't the only one to suspect the organics had something to do with this. "Can't say I disagree," Emmanuel said.
"No, it looked like everyone was as concerned about the alien technology as he was."
"But without an actual laboratory," Emmanuel continued, "I have no way of telling whether the bots are dead or active. Maybe there are just a bunch of dead bots accumulating in your liver and being cleansed from your blood. Might explain why you were able to wake up."
"Maybe,"
Sophie said. It didn't seem like she believed him. That worried Bauma. Holly seemed to be able to tell. She lifted herself from her seat next to the sleeping children and deposited herself into the one next to him, leaning her head against his shoulder.
"You're thinking about Lieutenant Smith, aren't you?"
she whispered. "You deduce all that with your psychoanalytical skills?" Bauma asked.
"It doesn't take a psychologist to tell me that. I know you, Chad. I was thinking the same thing."
"Smith betrayed us."
She opened Cheyenne Mountain to the organics, and they ran us out of there and nearly killed every one of us. Smith didn't betray us. It was the nanobots. They controlled her. You know, she never would have done that if it weren't for the organics.
That's kind of what I'm afraid of, Balma said, looking up at Sophie. This is supposed to be her mission. We're on Mars, where she wanted us to come, looking for a colony she wanted us to find. And now, right when we're finally headed in that direction, she wakes up as if the Arvamp blast back on Earth never happened.
She still seems like Sophie to me,
Holly said. Maybe, but how long before the organics use her like a puppet? Holly appeared to consider that. She rubbed the back of Balma's hand.
I can't explain it, but I don't get the same feeling from her that I did from Smith.
What do you mean? Balma wasn't sure he could tell if there was any distinction.
She seems more in control somehow. Maybe the last of the nanobots really were fried, and all it took was a prolonged rest in the cryo chamber for them to finally fizzle away. My guess is they probably feed on living people or get energy from biological systems, and when everything is shut down when a person is in cryo, maybe they're not feeding the bots anymore.
Maybe.
Balma shivered at the thought. But she's awake and alive now. What if the nanobots wake up too?
The rhino dipped and came up hard with a violent jerk. Ort smacked against the inner wall of the vehicle and cursed. Sorry, Diego called back. Terrain is getting a little rougher. We're going to have to slow down. Suspension is already shot, Ort added. No use beating up this poor thing more than we have to. She's the only wheels we have, and we're toast without her.
Ort's simple statement hit Balma hard. They might be the last hope for humanity. And they'd already lost Jeff and David. God, he wanted to curse and shout. His fingers slipped from Holly's. They trembled as he curled them into fists. The organics and the arrogance of those boys. He should have never tried to convince them they'd be warriors someday. Then maybe they wouldn't have run off in a heroic attempt to save the sunspot.
I screwed up, he said aloud.
Holly gave him a perplexed look. What?
Back in Cheyenne Mountain, I told Jeff and David they could be soldiers, that they were soldiers. Look at what happened.
It's not your fault.
They were just boys. They didn't deserve to go out like that.
A sudden heat flushed through his face.
Shit! I just keep thinking, what if they're still out there wandering around and wondering where we are?
We did everything we could for them, Holly said, a sheen of wetness covering her eyes.
Did we?
Balma raised a brow. We searched for them, but you saw that blast. And right now we've got others relying on us. Holly nodded toward the two sleeping children curled up in their seats. Balma brushed a fresh tear from her eye and then pulled her close. Together they sat in silence while Diego and Ort consulted with Sonia regarding their path forward. Sophie and Emmanuel continued discussing the nanobots and what her seemingly miraculous recovery might mean. Trying to reconcile their unknown future with their disastrous past, Balma had trouble focusing on the intense thoughts roiling through his head. He couldn't draw himself away from the images of Jeff and David in his mind's eye. He could picture them walking across the desert until they collapsed. Maybe they were still out there. But Holly and Emmanuel were both right. Their mission was to find the NTC colony. If they were successful, he could then launch a mission to find Jeff and David.
Hold on, boys, Balma thought. We'll find you.
Chapter 11
Athena sipped water and swished it around, savoring the cool liquid the organics had come to Earth to collect. Something humans had taken for granted for so long. And now billions upon billions of humans and animals had perished for the aliens' lust for the resource. She sat in the cracked leather chair on the bridge of the Ghost of Atlantis, looking over what was left of her crew, and waiting for Griffin, Malone, and Taylor to return from the hatch leading to outside. Almost all of her crew had huddled into the room to wait for the three soldiers. The stuffy air was ripe with a smell no one had really gotten used to. Tolerate would have been a generous way of describing their reaction to the constant stench of body odor and human waste. Of the original 120 NTC sailors, this was all that remained.
There were just 17 of them inside the cramped bridge. Half the crew had accompanied Captain Rick Noble during Operation Redemption, while the other half had remained behind. Then a storm had damaged the vessel, leaving it stranded on the ocean floor until the waters receded, which hadn't taken long. Most of the world's oceans had been drained to half their capacity by the start of Operation Redemption. The damage to the submarine had been severe. Cracking bulkheads had flooded several compartments with sand, destroying most of their communications equipment. They were deaf and blind, and the inside temperature was nearly 90 degrees. Fans connected to camouflaged solar panels in the sand above the vessel helped circulate some of the air, but it was still almost unbearable, especially with the stench. She scrutinized the filthy faces looking back at her on the bridge. Their features appeared almost ghoulish, illuminated as they were by lanterns. Trish Hodges sat next to their now useless communications equipment, a curtain of long hair hanging over one side of her face as she watched Athena. Bobby Posey, their senior engineer, or at least the most experienced engineer still left alive, sat next to Trish. The pale man rested his beard-covered chin in his hands. Sitting behind them were Farthing, Webb, and Stokes. They all shared the same melancholy looks. Stokes's once round cheeks and rotund belly had deflated. His cheekbones now stuck out of his gaunt, grime-covered face, giving him a near-skeletal appearance. He coughed and held up a hand to cover his mouth. Like most on the GOA, the navigation officer was ill. Over the tap of the transmitter and the sporadic coughs came the sound of footfalls in the corridor outside the bridge. Griffin ducked under the overhead and took his helmet off, revealing a dark-skinned face and sharp brown eyes. He scrunched his wide shoulders to fit through the hatchway. "Corporal, those things are gone," he reported. "Malone and Taylor are still topside, making sure they don't come back, but with the sun about to rise, I'd say this is our best shot to move."
"Move?" Trish asked,
looking away from the Morse code transmitter. Posey's hands fell off his beard, and he stood with an incredulous look on his face.
"What do you mean, move?" he asked.
Athena also stood. Her ribs hurt from the sudden movement, and a wave of dizziness rinsed over her. The can of beans and a few glasses of water had helped, but she was still exhausted and dehydrated. She walked over to a metal table in the center of the room. Shattered monitors that had once provided access to data, intel, and visuals of the outside hung from the bulkheads. They were down to using paper maps to guide them on their raids into Los Angeles. Griffin, Trish, and Posey met her at the table while the others gathered around to listen.
"Alexia has located an underground garage that might yield some vehicles that survived the initial blast. If we can get to them, they could take us to the Pelican AFB military installation where other survivors are taking refuge."
Athena pointed at the map.
"With their help, we will actually have a fighting chance to get out of here. We just need to make it to Pelican and..."
"To Pelican?" Posey asked, cutting her off. "With everything the organics have out there?" He chuckled nervously. "You lost Walker just walking into a deserted city. Now you want us to believe you can take us all to Pelican?" Athena looked at the engineer, but noticed the other frightened faces over his shoulder. Aside from Griffin, no one looked like they were up for another fight. She understood their fear, but it was madness living in these conditions.
"We can't stay here and wait to die," Athena said.
She paused to look at Posey.
"Actually, you can if you want, but I'm not planning on it. So if you want to stay behind, that's on you. I'm going to take a group to get these vehicles, then head to this base. Alexia is working on a plan for us to escape the planet."
"Escape the planet in what?" Posey snorted.
"Yeah, that's what I was trying to say when you cut me off."
This time Posey shrugged. "I've said it once and I'll say it again. That AI is going to get us killed." He turned to look at the others. "Alexia's gonna get us all killed. I say we stay here and wait for the organics to leave Earth. They can't possibly take all the water. Once they leave, we will head into Los Angeles and start over."
"I agree," said Collins, another communications officer. "I say we stay here and wait it out."
Athena listened to her crew argue back and forth for several minutes before she silenced them with a fist to the metal table.
"Look around you," she said,
gesturing toward the cracked monitors and dented bulkheads.
"There's nothing left for us here. We have maybe 2 or 3 weeks' worth of food left and a week of water. The organics aren't going to leave any behind. And even if they do, Earth is already dead. There's not enough water left on Earth to make it habitable anymore.
Griffin took off his helmet and set it down with a clank. Most of you haven't been out there, but I have. There isn't anything to go back to in L.A. either. We can't just start over.
Posey and Collins remained defiant.
You leave this submarine again and you will die, Posey said.
We stay in this submarine and we will die, Athena said.
She looked over at Trish and then Griffin, the two people she knew she could count on. They both nodded back at her with reassurance.
We should have done this 3 months ago when Dr. Winston and her team took the NTC sunspot, Athena said. The time for hiding is over. I'm getting those vehicles. When I come back, those of you that want to live are welcome to come with.
You ready?
Jeff asked. He crouched behind a piece of metal that jutted out from the ground like a robotic shark fin. David nodded his helmet. Before them lay the hulking wreck of the sunspot, its hull split open, the metal peeling outward. Globs of plastic had melted and then solidified in the dirt. Chunks of metal littered the ground like an alien junkyard. He checked his HUD for an oxygen readout, swallowing hard at the report of less than 10%. An animalistic urge told him to run straight for the sunspot and find an oxygen canister before he suffocated, but Balma had always told him a soldier didn't rush into battles he couldn't win. A real soldier gathered intel and made decisions based off weighing his options. Strategy and tactics were just as important as firepower.
"Stay behind me at all times," Jeff said.
David nodded again. They crept through the debris like cats sneaking up on a mouse. When they got close to the main wreckage, Jeff ordered his brother onto the ground. Together they crawled over the red sand, keeping as low as possible. Piece by ugly piece, they snuck through the scattered remains of the ship until at last they were just 50 meters from the bulk of what had once been the sunspot. While their EVA suits isolated noise they made to within their suit, Jeff still whispered as he pointed to a section of the sunspot near the stern, where what remained of the biomes could be seen. He recognized the twisted remains of one of the turrets.
"That's where we were before we escaped."
"Yeah, I think you're right," David said.
The hull near the turret was singed. Teardrops of melted slag had reformed along its sides. Jeff hoped there might be a couple oxygen canisters left there. It was the only shot they had, from what he could see. Of course, to get there, they'd have to sneak past the half-dozen spiders clambering over the hull. Through the wounds in the side of the ship, he could see the shapes of more aliens sifting through the shadows, their blue flesh illuminating the guts of the ship as they moved about. Near the bow, outside the broken hull, stood a scorpion-like alien with a huge catapult tail. Enormous arachnid legs arched from an armor-covered thorax. The monster's head looked vaguely bird-like with a falcon's beak, though multiple stalks sprouted from it, each carrying a gleaming eye. The beast seemed to be staring off into the distance, as if guarding the sunspot. Jeff pressed himself lower against the soil and continued moving. He kept his eyes on the glistening blue scorpion alien. Its huge, muscled legs shifted slightly, and its head started to swivel around. Grabbing David's wrist, Jeff pulled them both up and sprinted across the rest of the dry landscape. With a leap, he cleared the last meter, pulling David with him, and the pair tumbled into a hole in the side of the sunspot. His body rolled across the deck, kicking up a cloud of dirt. Had they been seen? He tried to manage his breathing, listening for the scratch, scrape, or any otherworldly wails. Beams of light penetrated the wounds in the ship, illuminating columns of dust. The noises of the aliens resonated through the metal bulkheads and up into Jeff's suit. Goosebumps prickled his skin as he waded into the darkness. A huge thumping soon followed. Jeff pressed himself into the shadows and pulled David with him, hoping the darkness would disguise them. They hadn't made it far enough inside the ship to hide from all the huge breaches in the hull of the sunspot. He feared the scorpion thing would look through one of those holes and see him, or David. The deck shook,
and bits of sand danced with each walloping tremble. David looked up at him like he was about to ask a question. Jeff pressed a finger against his face shield to silence him. His legs threatened to give out from under him as the noise of the beast grew closer, the vibrations growing louder and more violent. Jeff held a breath in his chest when he saw one of the massive legs through the hole in the side of the ship. The scorpion monster halted, and Jeff slowly let out his breath.
"Please keep moving."
The tree trunk legs pulsated blue outside their hiding spot. Seconds ticked by, taking what seemed to Jeff like an eternity. David squeezed his hand. The organic wasn't looking toward the ship, but facing away. Maybe on guard or watching for signs of more humans or something else. It didn't matter. All that did was that the alien hadn't seen them. At least not yet. The sooner they found their oxygen and got out of here, the better. Jeff's suit beeped in his ear. His oxygen was down to 5%. He dropped David's hand and motioned for him to follow. They snuck on through the sunspot's remains. Metal creaked all around them, and dust swirled in from all the wounds in the hull. The dwindling number on Jeff's HUD kept him moving through every obstacle they faced. The tap and scratch of spiders inspecting the vessel followed them through the corridors. Jeff tried his best to gauge where the creatures were, but found it difficult, given the way the noises echoed through the metal and his suit. And with half the floors missing, it was almost impossible to navigate through the treacherous fallen beams and twisted wires. He tried to remember where the turret was. That was the direction they needed to be going in, but with most of the ladders missing, Jeff hadn't seen a good way to get up to that deck. After a couple minutes of crawling under fallen panels and pushing through jumbles of burned computer panels, an answer presented itself to him. Jeff looked up where there had been a set of ladders leading up four decks. It looked like three of those decks had completely collapsed, and they could see all the way up to the top deck. The space appeared cavernous. A length of the top deck had fallen down, so it was nearly straight up from the level they were on. Pieces of pipe and scaffolding hung off it. Some swung in the wind, tunneling through the devastated ship. At the top of the deck was the turret room, and next to it, the armory where they had got their suits. There might not even be any oxygen up there. All the canisters had probably exploded along with the ship. How much oxygen would he use up just trying to make that climb? His HUD was still flashing red. Oxygen levels were now under 4%. What was it like to suffocate? Did it hurt? If he fell, even with Mars's weakened gravity, he bet it would still hurt. He'd be lucky if he came away from it uninjured. Being injured and trying to survive with organics around would be a death sentence. He wanted all of it to just be a nightmare, a long, terrible nightmare. "Bravery isn't about not being afraid," their dad's words echoed through his head. He sucked in a breath. He was more afraid than he'd ever been in his life. It wasn't just his life at stake. David's was at risk, too. But this wasn't the first time.
"How much oxygen do you have left?"
Jeff whispered.
"It says 6%. What about you?"
"Enough." Jeff motioned for David to follow, and they began moving toward the deck-turned climbing wall. Punctures in the outer hull let a few beams of light cast themselves across the wall, but most of it was obscured in shadows. This would make finding handholds and footholds even more difficult. Back in Cub Scouts, he had gone climbing with his dad in their pack. They had learned the basics of how to scale walls with predetermined routes and how to rappel down them. Jeff and some of the other boys had been frightened at the time, but Dad had told them not to worry. The climbing harnesses strapped about their waists would catch them if they fell. The people belaying them could always gently lower them back to the ground.
"There's no belaying rope now, though. No harness and no one to catch us."
"We got this, bud," Jeff said, patting his younger brother's back. "You just use your hands to steady yourself and your legs to push yourself up. Got that?"
"Push with my legs."
"That's right.
I'm going to let you go first, and I'll be right behind you."
"What should I grab first?"
David asked. Jeff pointed to a piece of the deck that had peeled away, leaving behind bare skeletal scaffolding.
David showed no hesitation. He found a handhold and pulled himself up. Bit by bit he ascended, with Jeff acting as his guide. They used the charred wiring and broken pipes to brace themselves. Where the plates on the deck had come loose, they found that the structure under it worked like a ladder. It wasn't nearly as bad as Jeff had thought. They could actually do this, and soon they'd be in the armory. They'd find themselves some oxygen canisters.
And then, what would be next?
Jeff's foot slipped. His weight shifted under him, and he kicked to regain his footing. He started to lose his grip on the chunk of decking he'd grabbed. A piece of charred plating fell away and clattered against the deck below. The impact let out a hollow, metallic ringing that echoed throughout the cavernous corridor. Regaining his grip, Jeff pulled himself close to the wall. His heart thumped rapidly in his chest, and he fought to control his breathing. David looked down, but Jeff couldn't see his brother's face in the darkness. Raising a thumbs up, Jeff indicated he was okay, and then he pointed to direct David to keep climbing. A scratching noise stopped them both before they could get much farther. Jeff pressed his body against the bulkhead, and David followed suit. But it was too late. The blue shape of a spider emerged over the top of the precipice. Light bleeding through one of the wounds in the ship's hull silhouetted the monster. Its mandibles clicked together like it was tasting the air. The alien must have heard the piece of plating hit the floor, but had it seen them yet? Jeff had to remind himself that the organic's sensors didn't detect volumes of water as small as children. The spider twisted a claw around the edge of the wall. David was only a meter under it, and Jeff was just half a meter below him. Maybe, like the scorpion alien, the spider was just making its rounds. But it continued to linger there on the edge. It was almost as if it already knew they were there and was just teasing them. What if it stood there until Jeff's air ran out? The spider shifted, and hope buoyed Jeff once again. It was actually backing up. They would be able to finish their climb and find an oxygen canister, and a hiss shot out of the spider's maw. It suddenly lunged forward, its claws slamming down around David.
No!
Jeff screamed. Chapter 12. A fire still burned in the back of Sophie's head. She couldn't tell if the pain was growing worse, or if her elation at initially seeing Emmanuel had momentarily stalled the tide of agony now building within her. A red hue seemed to float at the edge of her vision, threatening to encroach on her sight. She struggled to think straight at times, feeling her consciousness wash over her like the changing tides. "We're never going to find this colony," Diego said. "For all we know, we might have already passed it." The rhino's motors hummed as usual, adding to the pounding in her head. One of the wheels had progressively worsened from the damage it had sustained. Now, every time they went over particularly rocky terrain, the whole rhino bucked and the wheel groaned as if it might fall off.
"I don't think we've missed the colony yet," Sophie said.
The soldier shot her back a confused look. "How do you know?" Even Emmanuel appeared bemused.
"I'm not sure," Sophie said, "but I don't think we're anywhere close yet."
Diego's brow remained scrunched, even as he turned back to look out the windshield. She could tell he wasn't convinced. She didn't blame him. She had no way of knowing where the NTC colony was. The information available to her on its location was the same as the rest of the crew had. But something at the back of her mind told her it was true, and that they were headed in the right direction. Fear of the nanobots returned. Maybe they were slowly resurrecting within her, trying to take over again? A shudder ripped across her cold flesh. She was feverish and did all she could to prevent herself from trembling. "You okay?" Emmanuel asked.
"I'll be fine."
Emmanuel nodded, but the concern etched across his bearded face showed he wasn't convinced about her condition either. Thankfully, he didn't press the issue. Sophie took a moment to study the rest of the rhino. Owen and Jamie stared out the windows with groggy expressions. Balma and Holly sat nearby, keeping a watchful eye on them. Ord and Diego remained steadfast in guiding the rhino over the alien terrain at the front of the vehicle. A bit of cryostat fluid still sloshed around the floor. Some of it had evaporated, and the rest had been siphoned into the self-cleaning ventilation system. Thanks to the cryostat fluid going through the filters, there was a sweet tang to the atmosphere.
That sweetness only seemed to make Sophie's headache worse. There was no way to confirm it, but the more Sophie thought about it, the more certain she was that the nanobots were indeed coming back. What if the nanobots could replicate, like bacteria or viruses? What if they were propagating in her bloodstream and preparing to take over her brain? How long before she condemned the rest of the group, the people who might be the very last remnants of humanity, to a bloody death at the claws of the organics? Emmanuel was now working on one of the portable ARVAMPs he'd created. The small device was their last line of protection against the organics. Better that they avoid the aliens altogether than engage in combat, but at least they no longer had to fear the impermeability of those shields like they had at the beginning of the organic invasion. These weapons had given humanity a fighting chance.
"Sophie, your intuition's still telling you we're on the right track?" Diego asked from the front of the vehicle.
The flat landscape unrolled before them in a desert devoid of signs of either humanity or organics. And still, somehow, Sophie knew they were headed in the right general direction.
"Yes, keep going."
It gnawed at her that she couldn't explain how she knew this. All of this had something to do with her visions, the nanobots, and the organics. If her fate was going to be anything like Lieutenant Smith's back at Cheyenne Mountain, she couldn't rely on her intuition any longer. The particle physicist side of her kicked in. At heart, she was a scientist. No one had designed a spaceship to Mars because it felt right, or created cures for all kinds of cancers because their intuition told them the cure would work. No, they needed hard data and scientific principles. That was the only way to guide a spaceworthy ship for Mars, or create a nanoparticle drug delivery system to selectively zap cancer cells in the human body. She needed to don that science hat now, because whenever the nanobots took over and her mind failed, at least the rest of the crew would have hard data to take them to the NTC colony.
"Sonia, have you uncovered any signals that may be of interest?" Sophie asked.
"I have not, Dr. Winston."
Ort shook his head.
"We've already asked her the same thing a million times. Nothing."
Sophie wasn't convinced.
"No electromagnetic waves? No optical signals? Not a single suspicious X-ray?"
"No, doctor."
Sophie looked to Emmanuel.
"How's that possible? You don't just sit a human colony down here and let it get swallowed by a black hole."
"Maybe they've gone dark," Emmanuel said. "They've been quiet so the organics don't find them."
"Sure,"
Sophie started. A flame within her skull burned hotter. She pressed a hand to her temple in a futile attempt to assuage the pain.
"I understand radio silence, but there's no way a colony is surviving out here without electronics."
"Then Sonia would have reported them," Emmanuel said. "She wouldn't have missed that."
Something about that didn't sit right with Sophie. She'd worked closely with Alexia back on Earth and knew the power of AIs. Sonia seemed off somehow. Earlier, Emmanuel had mentioned that he thought her transfer wasn't complete. The AI was able to answer generic questions and help them operate the Rhino, but Emmanuel was right, something was missing. And Sophie reckoned she knew what that was.
"Sonia, can you tell me the status of your intuitive framework?"
"Such a framework does not exist,"
Sonia said.
"And why not?"
"Transfer from shipboard systems to the Rhino was not completed in time. Priority was given to functionality systems in lieu of systems deemed extraneous to mission success."
Doc, can you translate that into English?" Ort asked.
Sophie rubbed her head, leaning back against the Rhino's seat.
"Sonia started with the programming she thought we'd need to make it to the colony. She didn't send things like personality programs or AI intuition, all the bits and pieces that give AIs the ability to really think creatively. Those take forever to upload."
"Which means she doesn't understand subtext," Emmanuel added.
Ort snorted.
"Y'all are still losing me."
"When we asked if she sensed any signals, we weren't asking the right question," Sophie said.
"No signals means no signals," Diego said. "How's that wrong?"
Polly grinned, understanding immediately. She might not be a physicist or computational expert, but she was a psychologist, and Sophie knew she understood human thinking, and as a result, the weaknesses of non-human thought. She might be telling us she cannot and